You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jacob Silverman, staff writer at the New Republic, author of the upcoming book, Easy Money, co-written with Ben McKenzie, on the golden era of crypto scams. Meanwhile, day three of the Ketanji Brown Jackson hearings, Republicans have gone full QAnon. Joe Biden in Europe seeking new sanctions may announce a permanent troop increase in Eastern Europe. Great. The Russian assault seemingly stalled. And as the deal gets closer, Senate hawks look to scuttle the Iranian nuke pact. In Utah, the governor vetoes a transgender bill. Oklahoma, their state house has passed a near complete ban of abortions. If it passes the Senate and inevitably gets signed by its governor, it will be the most restrictive ban on abortions in the country. This is just beginning, folks. U.S.-UK trade deal will end tariffs on U.K. steel and aluminum and on U.S. whiskey, motorcycles, and tobacco.
Already on.
Despite the U.S. starving the Afghan people, Taliban essentially cancels girls' high school's education. U.S. vax rates stall as Omicron BA2 starts to grow. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Emma Vigeland's favorite day. Emma? It's a catchphrase. You got to go with your catchphrase.
It's hump day.
Yep, it is. Congratulations. Thank you. Thanks for coining that phrase and reminding us of it. So there you go.
It's a good metaphor.
Great. Yep. It is, in other words, like we're on the back end of the week, as it were.
Cresting.
Yep. And so we only have two more days after this. It's 5 days in a week. This
in
is
fact,
the third day.
It's actually not hump day because we are working on Saturday.
Well, for us this week, that's true. And just a reminder, if you go to Majority Live, and if you go to Majority Live, you can get tickets to the Boston show, which I thought would not sell out, but it's starting to look like it very well may.
Wow.
Now, it's
venue.
In May. It's yeah. a much bigger venue. It's three times the size. No, well, yeah, almost. Yeah, actually, it's exactly three times the size in Boston. I figured that would not sell out. It's not until May, but if you want to get tickets for it, you get 6 weeks, but it could sell out.
You might not have 6 weeks.
You may not have 6 weeks. If you want to, the Brooklyn show is obviously sold out, but if you want to watch the Brooklyn show, you have two choices. You can go to Majority Live. You click through. You can go as if you're buying tickets and then buy the live streaming event, or you just sign up for the AM Quickie, which 500 people have already taken advantage of this discount. So, you know, I can't quite tell if that's a good business move on my part or bad business move because it's over 50% savings
on your
streaming.
I think it's a good
the cost was them doing the AM Quickie?
Yeah, they sign up for the AM Quickie.
Which is a good it's a good little thing in the morning.
Yeah, it's a great thing.
I love
but
AM
we haven't figured out how to monetize that yet.
No, well, yeah.
Anyways, the point is, go to amquickie.com. You will have the opportunity to...
The point is that you get them hooked and then you start charging them.
That's, well, actually, that is sort of actually what I've been thinking.
Yeah, yours, weird camera thing you're doing today.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we
well,
go.
There you go. All I fixed right. it. Okay. So go to amquickie.com. The next day, you will get the AM Quickie in your mailbox, your email box, and then you will be able to get a 50% discount on the AM Quickie. There you go.
No.
All right, let's get into this. There's basically the story of these hearings appears to be, and I don't know that this, frankly, is what Mitch McConnell would have wanted, but, you know, it
oh,
is.
Oh, there's no way he wants this.
I would be very surprised. Because there's, I first off, I would be very surprised if Ketanji Brown Jackson does not get confirmed at this point. But Josh Hawley, he's got a future in the Republican Party as far as he's concerned. Tom Cotton has his lane. Marsha Blackburn has her lane. And
I don't know about Blackburn, but I would guess that Cotton and Hawley are running in 2024. I would guess.
Well, I think these guys, they plan to and wait and see. They want the opportunity to put themselves in the position to do it.
Unless Trump runs, then maybe they'll.
And I'm not convinced that Blackburn is not thinking about vice president.
Yeah.
So, and what you have is essentially two strains of Republican lines of attack that are essentially that self-reinforcing for their lunatic. You know, I've seen it described as the fringe and the base. There is no such thing as the fringe in the Republican Party. It is the base. And the base is broad base to the extent that there's a base there. It is broad. And that is they're lunatics. And it ranges from Cotton and Graham trying to argue that she is soft on crime. And then for those who want to know what crime, you have Hawley and Blackburn who are basically saying some type of, you know, you're soft on pedophilia and all that mishmash that goes into pedophilia with them, which includes like transgenderism and gay people and anything that deals with like anything that inhibits. Because, again, the right wing fixation on pedophilia stems from years ago when essentially women were able to leave the home to go and work. And kids needed daycare. Mm-hmm. And during the 80s, we had all these scares of pedophiles running and Satanists running daycare centers. And so this all ties back to essentially the same sort of like Christian fundamentalist version.
You can also tie CRT into that as well, because when, you know, if the mom's not at home, they're going to be indoctrinating your kids in the schools, right? That's where they're going to get their primary child rearing. So that's part of the not so subtle dog whistle that the
GOP. Well, they've
is
also got a nod
with.
To that because it's a black woman.
Yeah.
But here is, so let's, later in the program, we will sort of cover that end of the spectrum, but let's just start with this. Lindsey Graham. Again, he's not, some reason he's not as, gung-ho to enter into that world of sexuality that the Republicans have a problem with. I can't imagine why that would be, but, he is going for the soft on crime, which of course is how am I going to show like I'm a tough guy? And I know it's going to center around Club Gitmo.
Congressman Jim Clyburn was a strong supporter of Michelle Childs and now be supporting your nomination. And Michelle Childs has been nominated by President Biden to be a circuit judge, and she will be considered by this committee as quickly as possible. On the issue of Guantanamo, there are currently 39 Guantanamo detainees remaining. The annual budget for Guantanamo is $540 million per year, which means each of these detainees is being held at the expense of $12 or $13 million per year. If they would be incarcerated at Florence, Colorado, the supermax prison, federal prison, the amount would be dramatically, dramatically less. Since 9/11, nearly 1,000 convicted in the United States on terrorism charges. Since 2009, with the beginning of the Obama administration, the recidivism rate of Guantanamo detainees released is 5%.
So Mr. Chairman, according to the Director of National Intelligence, is 31%. Somebody is wrong here. If you're going to talk about what I said, I'm going to respond to what you said. If we close Gitmo and move them to Colorado, do you support indefinite detention under the law of war for these detainees?
I would just say I'm giving the facts. And
the answer is no.
I want to make sure that it's clear the 31% you referred to goes back to the year 2009.
What does it matter when it goes back to? We had them and they got loose and they started killing people.
Well, I could just say that
if you're one of the people killed in 2005, does it matter to you when we release them?
Suggest that a president of your own party released them.
I'm suggesting the system has failed miserably, and advocates to change this system, like she was advocating, would destroy our ability to protect this country. We're at war. We're not fighting a crime. This is not some passage of time event. As long as they're dangerous, I hope they all die in jail if they're going to go back and kill Americans. It won't bother me one bit if 39 of them die in prison. That's a better outcome than letting them go. And if it costs $500 million to keep them in jail, keep them in jail because they're going to go back to the fight. Look at the friggin' Afghan government. It's made up of former detainees at Gitmo. This whole thing by the left about this war ain't working.
Let me also note that Larry Thompson, who served as Deputy Attorney General under President George W. Bush, Orrin Kerr, Special Counsel, Viet Dinh, who served as Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy in the George W. Bush administration, John Bellinger.
If you're just listening, Lindsey Graham walked off in a huff there. Of those 39 that are still in Guantanamo Bay, 27 have not even been charged. 14 have been cleared to be released. This is...
But you can't release them because we're at war.
We can't release them.
Always
because,
at war.
And we have literally driven these people insane.
Yeah.
With torture. The 12 that are still awaiting trial, that have been charged, can barely be tried because we tortured so many of them that we can't even hold a trial.
Well, was that the Guardian piece from the other day? Was that about Gitmo? The detainee who was used as a
trainee prop to be taught how to torture people.
They banged his head against the wall so many times that he has significant brain damage, among other torture techniques.
To the practicalities of keeping us safe, the idea that Gitmo doesn't create more anti-American violent sentiment than allowing these people some sort of rights.
Lindsey Graham sat idly by while the president he supported denied the existence of a pandemic that has taken the lives of 1 million people in this country. There is no way in 1 million years the number of people we have released from Guantanamo Bay are responsible for the deaths of Americans like the former president of this country who convinced half the nation that COVID was a hoax. So if we're really concerned about American lives, apparently we can spend hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, I think that's the hundreds of millions of dollars. Sure. Yes, that is a problem. But it's also just an abomination. It's just a moral abomination. And it makes a mockery of the Constitution that these people preen about. And so, there's Lindsey Graham's little performance art.
Yeah, I mean, she was Ketanji Brown Jackson was just sitting there can I go? I mean, she didn't say one word in that.
No.
And
apparently he was talking all over her just 10 minutes ago
yeah.
in the, during the hearings.
This is his
preening. This is the way that he establishes maybe getting a little soft on Trump, and he's got to make sure he doesn't get that primary in South Carolina, and this is part of the way that he does it. But
he had success with Kavanaugh. He wants to play the hits now.
Yep. There you go. All right. In a moment, we'll be talking to Jacob Silverman, staff writer at New Republic. He's got a new book that is that is upcoming, Easy Money. It's co-written with Ben McKenzie, who I've been told was on a television program that I'd never heard of, so apologies. But on crypto. And this is a particularly, I guess, opportune moment to scam people. But before we get there, a couple of words from our sponsors today. As you know, recent IPCC report came out. I mean, horrible news, not good. Antarctica, 70 degrees warmer than ever been.
Oy.
That's bad in Celsius and Fahrenheit.
Yep. Our own individual actions are not going to solve climate change, but it is a part of the solution. And that means that for some of us who own homes, we can go solar. Solar consultant, who has been a longtime listener of this program, used to work in the solar industry, felt like some of this was a little bit predatory, and that homeowners didn't really have a sense of what they were doing. He's become a consultant, and if you're a homeowner, you may have considered solar, but of course, you don't know where to start. A lot of homeowners don't realize that there are solar options currently available for them, that there's also a solar investor tax credit, which is going to get reduced from 26% down to 22% next year. So now is the time to do this. You can also now retrofit a home with solar panels, in many instances, with no money down. So my solar nerd's mission is simple. And it's to help you find the best solar program for your home and make the transition as easy and smooth as possible. The way they do it, they analyze your usage. They find the best equipment for your needs. They determine the incentives and financing you qualify for. Then they project manage between you and the installers, obtain permits, et cetera, et cetera. Look, do this now. Some of the tax credits and incentives are going to be sunsetting. The 26% tax credit drops down to 22% next year. If you finish the project by the end of this year, you qualify for the 26% tax credit, so there's still plenty of time. Some markets that are prone to power outages, you may qualify for off-grid backup solutions. So my solar nerd comes in. They handle all of these questions that you have, and they oversee the process. Majority Report listeners are going to get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. So check it out. Go to mysolarnerd.com, mysolarnerd.com. Fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select Majority Report listener for how you heard about My Solar Nerd. Receive $200 gift card upon installation. Also, it's back, Emma.
No.
Yep.
No.
2022. We have high-speed internet. You have celebrities going to space. You got electric cars. And yet, what is the one thing that most people are still doing like they did literally centuries ago? Yes, that's right. And how do you stop doing it that way and move into the future? Hello, Tushy Bidets.
Right.
Yep. Oh, my God.
Read it.
Because smearing your business around with toilet paper is so 100 years
ago. Oh, it's worse than I thought.
Yep. they go all in. But I will say this, folks. Once you go bidet, you don't go back. You don't go bidack. The Hello Tushy Bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. Think about it for 1 minute about how you wash your hands. You don't do it with a dry piece of paper for a reason. You simply spray and pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. There is no electrician or plumber needed. It is super easy. If you can change your toilet seat, you can do this. Installs in less than 8 minutes, and it cuts down your toilet paper use by 80%. Saves you money, saves paper waste, and it is just a revelation. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all our listeners to have clean bums, as you know. You can visit hellotushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's HelloTushy.com/majority. You get 10% off and tag HelloTushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. Do not post explicit pictures, please. We will put links to both those in our podcast and YouTube descriptions. Check it out. All right. Want to take a quick break. Forgot we got to do that. And when we come back, Jacob Silverman, staff writer at the New Republic, author of the upcoming book, Easy Money, co-written with Ben McKenzie. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Jacob Silverman, staff writer at the New Republic, author of the upcoming book, Easy Money, co-written with Ben McKenzie. Jacob, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. I had to concede that I didn't know who Ben McKenzie was, and I had never seen The O.C., but this happens with just about any cultural reference that we have. Emma has corrected or at least updated me. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I want to give us a sense of like where we are with crypto. And then I'm going to ask you to explain NFTs because I still don't quite fully get it, I think. But like, where are we in terms of just like there seems to be hundreds of cryptocurrencies and every day there are new ones. Mm-hmm. Where are we in that, you know, as in that measure of cryptos?
Right. Well, we're sort of in the biggest phase that crypto has ever seen, the biggest boom. I think a lot of people even within the industry wouldn't deny that there's some kind of bubble here. There are over 18,000 cryptocurrencies, of course, maybe only 100 or depending on who you ask, two or three might be really of consequence, but, and a lot of them are worth near zero, but, it's still a big time for the industry. There's hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of venture capital flowing in. You have, VCs mostly, like Andreessen Horowitz or some, Paradigm, some of these other associated venture capitalists. There's still an era of easy money, as we call our book. Things might change a little bit with the increase in interest rates that seems to be ongoing.
That part about the easy money, like mm-hmm. what are they investing in? I mean, this is the thing, like, are they like, cause I mean, to, you know, and I think, you know, people who listen to this program, on a consistent basis know that I just perceive it as, you know, one step up from tulips. Like these are essentially digital baseball cards as far as I'm concerned. But what is it that you're investing in? Are VC just coming in and saying, like, we're just going to buy a bunch of this and hope that it just goes up? Or are they actively, like, building some mechanism to increase its value?
Well, I think that gets at some key issues here, which is that, so you'll have a VC come in. For example, yesterday, Yuga Labs, the company behind the Bored Ape Yacht Club, the biggest NFT collection, which is sort of a proliferating brand, right. They got a bunch of VC money for the company that distributes and produces the NFT collections. And they got money from Andreessen Horowitz and some of the other big VCs. So that's, you know, you'll see investments in some of these companies that are creating currencies. Sometimes they're very small organizations or are creating NFTs, and they're all promising kind of a proliferation of different forms of IP, like a cartoon and a video game and all these things, all of it supposedly interoperable. Whether we ever see those things, I have real doubts. The reason why you have very rich venture capitalists and other moneyed interests who want to pour money into this stuff is because, say, and again, I'm going to often go back to Andreessen Horowitz, which is sort of the dominant player here, but they say you can get, instead of just traditional equity in a company, you can get tokens. So, for example, Yuga Labs has a token, which they unveiled last week. And if you bought equity in the company, I'm not saying this is happening in this specific case, but it does happen. Companies like, or the venture capitalists get tokens. So instead of stock options, they can unload those tokens whenever the initial coin offering happens, which is usually a matter of months rather than a matter of years for a stock offering. So in a lot of ways, it's a way to kind of get around securities regulations and obtain an interest in these companies and then pump and dump at the proper time.
Okay. So, by token, I mean, it's like a, you know, one unit of their currency or something, or units of their currency. Is that it?
Exactly. Coins, tokens, cryptocurrency is generally the same thing.
What? Like, okay. So I go and there's somebody says to me, I have $100 million, because of all this. And somebody says, like, I'm starting a crypto, the currency. And this is a, you know, I don't know what differentiates it. Maybe you can tell us on that, but what the pitch is. I need, an investment of $20 million. Okay. Here's the $20 million. What does the $20 million do? Like, I mean, is it buying a bunch of computers, or is it just like a marketing thing, or like, what is, I understand the idea of like, oh, you're going to give me, you know, we're going to create value here. You're going to give me one of those. I'm going to be able to dump it later. But what does that money do when it goes in there?
Right. Well, there's very little productive value in this whole system, in this economy. You know, a lot of it's built on sort of hype and shared delusion, because these cryptocurrencies and the companies behind them don't necessarily do a lot of things beyond even just have the tokens. So to think that all this could sink to zero or just become a series 18,000 penny stocks is not unreasonable, I think. But there are also a couple ways in which the money comes in. So you have a venture capital infusion, perhaps. But where does that money go? It either goes into marketing or it goes into the pockets of the owners. I mean, so much of the expenditure, such as it is in this industry, is around marketing. Get the celebrity endorsements, the social media campaigns. Mm-hmm. There's also darker stuff going on at some of these companies with basically buying bots on Discord and Telegram and other popular social media networks. There are fees that are paid to the exchanges to list your coin. And sometimes people pay companies to trade in their coin to increase volume. So there's that kind of stuff going on. But you're right that in terms of where the money goes, it's a little bit of a black box, but also it mostly goes into kind of keeping the froth and the hype going.
Also, for celebrities, it's a way for them to commodify their like current fame quadrant or fame unit, right? And for basically the pyramid scheme that is these crypto people, it's a way to get more people to buy it. So the people that initially have the bought the cryptocurrency have the bulk of it, the value of their currency is inflated. Is that an accurate assessment?
Absolutely. There are two things going on there. One is that the industry always needs more fiat, more regular dollars or euros or whatever coming in the door, because everyone always wants to get back to fiat. That's what you can buy stuff with. You can't really buy much with crypto, and you have to pay the bills usually in fiat. And then the other thing is the greater fool theory, as it's called, which is just that one of these things is worth as much as you can sell it for the next to the next fool for. Excuse me. So there's not a lot of inherent value here. There's not a lot of sustainable value being created. It's really about, okay, I own ApeCoin at $12 now. Hopefully I can sell it tomorrow for $15.
So, all right. So before we move off this sort of specific aspect of it, I'm still sort of amazed by this because it sounds like the entire investment is just for marketing. And it is literally just sort of like, we're just going to create a concept that is just a digital marker, essentially. So have you seen like a prospectus? Like, I mean, are there crypto enterprises out there with a prospectus and walking into the door of these VC offices or whatever it is and saying like, this is what I have. Like, I'm just fascinated as to what it is that they're selling. Like, how is me, you know, venture capital, all this, how do I determine that like this person walking in versus that person walking in and they both want me to invest in their crypto? How do I make the determinations which one sounds sexier? I mean, and I'm not being facetious, but like, sure. Like, have you seen a prospectus?
Well, a lot of these companies will publicly display what they call roadmaps, or they'll have a white paper that's sort of a more technical explanation of perhaps their token and what they're up to, or the tokenomics, as it's called, because their token might then be tied into sort of other financial protocols and other crypto protocols. And but a lot of it is based on sort of future promises. We're going to have a game. The NFT is going to provide you with real world experiences. You're going to have access to X celebrity or something like that. You know, there are things like NFT games or other kind of crypto economies out there, but most of it is just a promise of future worth or future access that very well may never appear. At least that's sort of the promise sold to customers. As for VCs, I think one criticism you hear a lot in this industry is that there is very little incentive for venture capitalists to try to help nurture and create sustainable businesses in Web3 or crypto, no matter what you think of venture capitalists. Their main motivation, of course, is to make more money. So if their main, I'd say, rubric or criteria is probably, is this token going to go up? Do they have good marketing? And when can I cash out? So I think those are some of the core questions that they ask themselves when they're considering, you know, A or B.
When you talk about the promises made for people basically buying crypto, normies or whatever, right? Like, it's fairly indistinguishable from a modern scam artist. Like, I read your piece in the New Republic where you talk about the Firefest. I mean, this sounds like what Billy McFarlane said when he was selling that fake Magnesis, that credit card, to a bunch of his of people who wanted early access to celebrities. I mean, there's like a deep, I kind of want to table that and come back to that, because that says something psychologically about the generation that we're in, I think. But I was hoping that we could back up to really the origins of crypto and how it started, because I remember Silk Road. I remember like a lot of conversations about how cryptocurrency, I didn't fully understand it then, but a lot of that, it seemed like it was a way for illicit goods and services to move through undetected. And now that technology is being used and has exploded, and traditionally, you know, buttoned up organizations, venture capital firms are investing in it now. So just take us to the beginning there. And I also want to ask you about Bitcoin a little more specifically as well.
Sure. I believe the Bitcoin white paper came out in October 2008. I mean, some people portray it as a response to the financial crisis. And I think certainly in how crypto in general beyond Bitcoin has developed, and some of the things that you hear about, you know, the big banks have failed us and things like that, is sort of grafted on to the crypto narrative. From what I understand, the original white paper may have been more about some libertarian ideas of finding kind of a peer-to-peer cash and payment method that didn't involve the government. I think it also had a lot to do with gambling and helping, because a lot of people in early Bitcoin came out of the world of online gambling and poker. And you see that also in the present-day crypto companies. A lot of these people have experience in online poker or gambling, and you can understand why. The market sort of limped along for a few years, really in a big, until 2017 was the first real big bubble. I mean, you can, there's some milestones before Silk Road is definitely important. As someone told me, there's one reason why Bitcoin has some very ardent defenders besides the sort of ideology they see in it is because a number of people got onboarded basically chasing the high of drugs or having the excitement of using it to obtain drugs. So there's a certain kind of thrill seeking, I think, and illicit aspect to it almost built in there from the beginning. But 2017, 2018 is when you had this explosion of coin offerings after the advent of Ethereum and other blockchains. And that's when you have celebrities start getting involved, celebrities start getting in trouble with the SEC, occasional enforcement. But then what you have now is a huge, there's infinite more variety of coins and protocols and things like that. And you and the whole market is notionally worth about 1.8 or 1.9 trillion. And again, if people really try to cash out, I think you'd find that number be a lot less. But that's what it's being touted as right now. So it's the biggest it's ever been. But at the same time, the actual use cases, I would argue, are still very few, if any.
Is there a, is there an algorithm? Like, you know, like I assume like if it's worth one point, like, I mean, do we know how much, okay, if it's worth $1.9 trillion, let's say, or 1.5 or whatever it is, the value of it is now, do we know how much actual real money went in to create that now ostensible value? And then I also wonder if that is, if 1.9 trillion is reflective of, let's say, I don't know, $100 billion that went in, that has been invested in, or you know, whatever number it is, or maybe it's just like 500 million of actual cash. And it just created this value essentially as people started to see, or I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how to, I guess there's probably a lot more than 500 million in there, right? Because it has attracted so much investment, people buying into this. But do we know what the relationship is between the actual cash that has been invested and what is on paper? And then do we have a sense of, for every dollar that is taken out, if there was to be sort of a run on this, like what would be the rate in which that deflates?
Right. So I think those are great questions. We don't know the precise answers, but I have some ideas. I mean, Ben and I have talked to folks who from in the industry who have proposed that maybe there's only sort of 10% real cash in the system. Of course, that I think that refers more to perhaps how much has gone in. But certainly there's a huge disconnect both between the on paper sort of digital value, the $1.8 trillion market cap of all currencies, and however much real money has flowed in. If you consider Bitcoin is over 40%, I believe, of that market cap. You know, a lot of the fiat that flows into the system is really just to pay miners' electrical bills. Or you have these crypto companies that raise venture capital and then probably waste on marketing. But in terms of cashing out, that's an open question. I think if there's a crash, which certain macroeconomic factors and law enforcement and other things could contribute to one, I think this year, then you could have sort of proverbial bank runs on some of the big coins. Exchanges might shut down or might not be able to process the volume of transactions. A lot of sort of strange knock-on effects, but basically the equivalent of a digital bank run. And I think the amount of money that people would actually get out would be a fraction of that. We're talking 1% or something. I just don't see people being able to cash out quickly and as a large group. Even recently, some of the stories about, you know, Russian oligarchs trying to take money, crypto money out of Russia, there's certainly some success at that, but there are also stories about they can't because there's not enough liquidity in these markets. So if you want to cash out $2 billion worth of Bitcoin, as supposedly some oligarchs want to do, you have to have a very generous sort of connection in Abu Dhabi or Switzerland to actually do that, but it's unlikely that that can even be done. So this question of liquidity, I think, also matters.
Also, then that it just totally undercuts the democratizing element, right? Like, if you want to cash out, you got to be connected to this wealthy person. But like you mentioned, the electricity. We cut out for a second there. You mentioned the electricity and how how people don't necessarily realize how environmentally harmful mining Bitcoin is. But I'm also really fascinated by the inefficiency in the technology in and of itself, because my understanding is that so Bitcoin can only process like something that was some finite number of transactions per second, and it clogs up the transaction system. So people will try to sell Bitcoin and it doesn't go through. Or, I mean, because this was initially created for the purposes that you outlined earlier, there is a lot of not just inefficiency, but incompetence in terms of the way that the actual mining is done and the trading is done. Can you talk about that too? Because having that amount of cash dependent on this kind of technology that has so many ways that it could fall apart, that's precarious to say the least.
Absolutely. I mean, Bitcoin is, or crypto in general, it's bad economics in that it's private money controlled by corporations and whales, basically. And it's also bad technology. I'm not a computer scientist, but I've talked to a number, and I've yet to really speak to a technologist or computer scientist who's not financially invested in crypto, who says that blockchain and crypto specifically is a good thing, basically, from a technological perspective. These networks are very slow. Right now, there's an interesting piece recently in Time Magazine about Vitalik Buterin, the founder of Ethereum. But one of the main points was that Ethereum is actually too popular because it's the second most popular blockchain after Bitcoin. But the Ethereum network is overcrowded, so it has very high gas fees, which is basically a transaction fee. So they would actually be better off right now because Ethereum doesn't have much capacity if it got less popular. And so you see this throughout crypto, which is that these technologies aren't necessarily as robust and as powerful as they claim to be. There are issues with basically the immutable nature of blockchains, which you can add information to, but you can't delete. This shows up a lot in what are called smart contracts, where basically if you do something wrong, you can't undo it. And that's how you lose $20 million through one misclick.
It's like Venmo. If you Venmo the wrong person, basically, yeah, you can't get it back. I mean, that's insane to me.
And there's no insurance or anything like that, of course. There's no regulatory process or bureaucracy, however cumbersome, to help you. There's no person on the other end of the line. So that's one thing that really strikes me is not only the bad economics and the sort of the lack of political governance, but you talk to people who really know their stuff and don't have a financial stake in this. Nicholas Weaver is a great example. He talks about this a lot on Twitter and elsewhere and in his writings, computer scientists at Berkeley, that these networks just aren't very good or robust. The technology is not that impressive or flexible. And Visa, for example, you can look up the numbers, but the Visa or MasterCard network is much more active and heavily used with much less electrical or computational expenditure than any blockchain.
So I'm just sort of a lot of this just feels like this is a direct function of wealth inequality in the world and just people with just like, I've got my whatever it is, my 10 million, my 50 million, I've got the extra billion, and I'm going to see if I can turn that into 30 billion by just like investing in this and seeing if enough people bite. I mean, that's why, like, I wonder if, you know, if there is this crash, if it doesn't just reinflate almost immediately because there's so much money concentrated in so few hands now, it feels like, in the context of this country, but also I think, you know, sort of worldwide, that there's always going to be somebody in there who's going to be like, I can reinflate this market tomorrow and everybody will come back in. And then I'll just get out in, I don't know, 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think even if this all crashes and people lose a lot of money, including I think a lot of everyday retail traders who maybe can't afford to lose a few thousand dollars or something like that, we'll see another version of again probably really soon. For example, I think some people are going to simply blame the government or some other outside force, especially if the government has a role in kind of popping this bubble, which I don't know how much enforcement they're going to actually do. But I think you're just going to see other people say, we need to do it better this time. And that does stem from the economic conditions in this country, which is sort of a lot of inequality and really a form of casino capitalism where gambling feels like one of the main ways to get ahead. I mean, of course, I talk about this stuff all the time, so that influences what ads I see. But on Twitter, I pretty much only see ads for crypto and for sports gambling, which is now legal and everywhere in New York. And I think those are sort of products of the same economic conditions, which is just that, I mean, I don't know how else I'm going to transcend my economic conditions. I'm going to throw some money down the latest speculative fervor, and maybe I'll be one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, I mean, there really is Sam, I like sports gambling, so that's why he's looking at me. But I really don't bet that much. It's more for fun, not to defend myself all the time. But,
no, I'm not anti-gambling. If you know the risks, that I think that's fine. Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, I am interested in it as a manifest. You call it casino capitalism in your piece, and you just said it there. But it really is just late stage capitalism, is it not? I mean, there is a mass desire from people to, understandably so, knock down the door of this like palace of capital that is accessible to only certain people. And it's kind of this false promise of democratization where it's like, I mean, you know, the Gatsby green light or whatever, that you can never reach it. And it's, I mean, we've become an established way, or I guess a socially acceptable way to scam people. And that seems like that, you know, I don't know, that's a business model that goes hand in hand with gambling and like with the other scams like Theranos or Firefest that have dominated the news cycle over the past few years.
Yeah, we argue that we live in sort of a golden age of fraud. We're not the first to the term, but that economic conditions combined with sort of a general tolerance for more risk, perhaps, and lack of enforcement from authorities, and a number of other things that have contributed to this kind of rampant forms of fraud. White-collar criminals seem to be getting away with it. They get Netflix series. They don't go to jail. Or maybe they'll go to jail and get the Netflix series. But I think, you know, crypto isn't necessarily inherently fraudulent, but it's very well suited for it, and it attracts both technologically, and it attracts a lot of people with experience in fraud. So I can't tell you the number of people who I've talked to who have said they've been scammed, many of whom remain true believers in this stuff, but it really is endemic, despite what some people might want to think.
What do the scams look like? I mean, I've heard stories. Mm-hmm. I've heard stories almost firsthand of like, friend of mine's brother was like walking their dog in like a LA dog park, and somebody came up and gave them said like, I'm giving out like $100,000in some type of crypto as a way of jumpstarting it in some fashion. I mean, it wasn't actually, didn't turn into $100,000 until other people were convinced it was worth $100,000. And then I think it just all sort of like dissipated. I mean, that's the mm-hmm. VC money, right? Somebody's just coming in and saying, can you turn this million into 10 million? And well, the way we do it is by getting some people who seem to be like mavens or, you know, to go out. And so what do the scams look like?
Well, the general model is similar to what you were just describing, which is basically MLM. And there are different ways in which mm-hmm. that's achieved. But in terms of specific scams, there are things called rug pulls, which are basically the leader of a project will just abscond with all the money, which is a lot easier to do when a lot of these people are anonymous, especially in the world of DeFi or decentralized finance. This happens with NFT collections too. Maybe people prepay or they buy in the beginning and they're promised, again, a lot of features or future access, and then the leader just disappears. That's a very common one. Coordinated pump and dumps in which, you know, insiders are cashing in. I'm working on a story. It's a bit of a difficult one, but of a pretty major, crypto company scamming its own employees, basically lying about compensation, and it involves tokens and other things. But, you know, 'cause some people are getting paid in tokens. So there are many varieties. A lot of them are sort of twists on traditional financial scams, and there are a lot of hacks, people clicking on the wrong link. Security is a major issue, but I think the constant here is that risk always devolves onto the individual in the crypto economy. And when something goes wrong, you're mostly out of luck, even if it happens on Coinbase or one of these big exchanges. And it's a lot of, you know, one of the mottos of crypto is DYOR, do your own research. And some of the people I talk to say, oh, I was scammed, but, you know, I didn't really research the person enough. It's kind of on me. I hear that all the time.
And to be clear, the reason why this is so susceptible to scamming is the anonymity is built into the system. So, as opposed to a situation where it's like, hey, send me $4,000, write the check just to cash. And I would be like, hey, wait a second. Why am I writing it to cash? Why don't I write it to your name? In this instance, it's like, write it to cash because that's the whole system. That's the way the whole system works. So there's no way to differentiate. There's no way to do that research really on a person at the end of the day, because the anonymity and the idea that like, that's a feature, not a bug of all this, is that like, we can take this cash and just run away and no one will know. And that's the whole point of it.
Yeah. I mean, recently there was a story about a guy working on a very prominent, he was the treasurer, actually, a very prominent DeFi protocol, meaning he basically controlled hundreds of millions of dollars worth of crypto on behalf of people who had staked money and things like that. And he went under this name Sifu. Well, of course, not his real name, of course. And then he was recently unmasked as one of the co-founders of Quadriga, which was a crypto exchange, which in sort of typical fashion collapsed when the founders, including him, absconded with all this money. So he just came back under another pseudonym and got very involved in a very lucrative crypto project. So you see that kind of thing a lot. There's just, an essential part of kind of doing business and even securities laws is disclosure. And both disclosure of who you're dealing with, where's money going, and also sometimes what kind of risks are involved. And you just don't see that anywhere here, besides the lack of enforcement and lack of political governance. So it's really easy to just kind of get around the most basic checks.
Well, do your own research too, right? Is difficult when a lot of the material out there is written by people who have a ton of crypto in stake. Like, I mean, I have a friend that was I'm listening to this podcast. I think I should buy some crypto. Look it up. Oh, that person, is very intimately involved in this current kind of cryptocurrency and has a huge investment in other people buying crypto. So this, yes. So their stakes and prices inflated. I mean, and we're talking about crypto scams and what constitutes a crypto scam. I mean, I'll just say it. Say it, isn't the irony of it all just a big scam in and of itself? Isn't it just a multi-level marketing scheme?
Exactly. I'm glad you got back to the multi-level marketing thing, because I think that's what we're talking about, which is your friend, just out of self-interest, needs you to buy in to pump their own bag, as they say in the industry, to it's a rising tide lifts all boats situation. They may want you to buy their currency or the one they're invested in, that's best, but really, there aren't a lot of incentives to ask tough questions in this industry. I think there are some good journalists, but also there's a lot of cheerleading. There's a lot of false information, outright disinformation. So people don't really want to hear the bad news or start asking how much underlying value is there here. It's just hype and celebrity endorsements, more ads, keep pushing, keep shilling, because eventually, line go up or number go up is a meme in the industry. This is all just about ensuring that number go up.
How is this, and maybe you can explain like the underlying blockchain technology, which is always sort of like, it seems to me to be the sort of second, a second order way of somewhat being supportive of crypto. Like, I don't know about cryptos, but the blockchain technology that underlies it really is going to have some interesting applications. Because it seems to me, I guess this is a two-part question, that crypto is nothing more than like, and I guess, I just sort of was reintroduced to this term, reading about how we've decimated Afghanistan's banking system. But the hawala. I mean, isn't that what it is? Like, I know a guy in Afghanistan who has a trusted guy in New York, and I wire him money. And so the way that I get money to my family in Kabul is I give it to this guy in New York. He takes a little vig, and then he sends it to his guy. They take a little vig, and then they get it to my parents.
Right. It's interesting you say that, because someone recently did describe crypto to me as potentially digital hawala. I mean, it's a comparison I'd like to look at more. I think the main difference is just that it makes sense as a way to transmit money and transmit value to someone else, especially in a difficult area. The main difference is just that crypto has become, as sometimes said, it's for transmitting money or for remittances, but it's really about speculation. So while Hawala moves a lot of money and is actually a very effective system around the world, but it actually moves it it's more effective arguably than crypto. It moves it at a low rate through trusted parties, and there's no unnecessary speculation attached.
And there's accountability.
Yes.
Right? Because I know I gave it to this guy, and that guy knows he gave it to that guy. So there's like some type of way to follow at least the money if it doesn't show up at my parents' place. And so, well, what about blockchain? Like, what, mm-hmm. like, is that, is there, like, it seems to me that blockchain is just like a digital ledger on some mm-hmm. level that is secure. Are there other applications that are going to be, you know, I guess are going to open up a whole new way of doing something?
I would say no, but I would get yelled at, as I often do, by crypto and blockchain advocates. I'm trying to be open to the idea that there are use cases or possibilities. I think there are a couple things going on here. I think the most likely use cases beyond just sort of cryptocurrencies are probably in sort of the back end of banking or logistical systems, in the plumbing, really, especially in banking where some stuff is running on 40 or 50-year-old code. But I don't think, based on my limited technical understanding, but also the people who I talk to who know a lot more than me, that the blockchain itself is necessarily a revolutionary innovation. It is basically a distributed ledger, a database that you can add information to that does have a consensus mechanism to make sure that people aren't manipulating it. But you can't delete anything. It consumes a lot of power. It's not very fast or effective, as we talked about earlier. So I don't see it as the revolutionary technology it's portrayed as. I think that's why you get a lot of mystification and salesmanship in blockchain and in crypto, which is because with the lack of use cases, you have to hype up the tech itself and say, well, eventually we'll figure it out or we'll find it soon. But we're basically 13, 14 years kind of into the crypto experiment, and the use cases aren't quite there. And blockchain itself is actually from the early 90s.
And let's just talk briefly about NFTs, because mm-hmm. I feel like I'm at the same place with NFTs as I was probably like 6 or 7 years ago with crypto, which is like, I mean, I guess, you know, and maybe it's just over my head. Like, I don't understand the concept here. But as far as I can tell, it is just taking something that's arguably more tangible than even crypto, I guess, because it's a specific representation a lot of times, or it can be anything, right? That you can in some way, do you have to visually see or I guess hear, you have to see or hear, not necessarily touch, but see or hear, right? So that it is like, you can sort of encircle some type of digital space, as it were. And
it's a receipt for a piece of art. That's what
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, actually, encircle is a good word too, because I've heard enclosure refer to sort of enclosing the commons, if you want to be intellectual about it. But yeah, it's basically a receipt saying you own this thing that's still stored on a server somewhere else. And I think this speaks a lot to what you see in crypto and Web3 and all this stuff is a real reverence for property rights, for traditional kind of meat space property rights, and trying to impose that on the digital world really ineffectively, but still trying very hard with a lot of ideological fervor attached sometimes, which is like, we need to impose artificial scarcity. We need to let people own stuff and sell stuff and trade stuff, even if the systems are complicated and don't really work and don't necessarily have a lot of inherent value. That's where you get the complicated financialization of all this stuff. But that urge towards artificial scarcity and property rights from a decidedly right-wing perspective, I think, is behind a lot of this.
Was the theory behind it like, hey, you know, an artist will do, you know, a series of I mean, back in the day, actually, I owned a Giger statue, H.R. Giger, the guy who did it.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, I sold it, and now it's worth like probably 15 times more than I sold it for, because I hit a little roadblock at one point. I had to sell it, and but back then, that's not the story. But it was like, it was number 7 out of a run of 35. And in this instance, with the NFTs, it's like, this is proving, like, this is number one. Like, you can do all these other copies, but this is number one. And that's what you have. But it seems to me that the whole point of 7 out of 32 was that the mold for this statue was going to deteriorate each time you use it. So 32, the artist chose 32 because it had gotten so degraded by you get to 33 that he was like, it's not my work anymore. And the value, the closer you were to one, increased because it was theoretically the closest to the artist's vision. But in the digital world, with those monkeys or whatever it is, my copy of number two looks just like number one.
It's a screenshot.
It's just to pretend as if it was diminished, but it really, again, is just sort of like, it's all make-believe. Like, if the person who owns it dies, and anybody who can attest to it being number one, there's no, I mean, art itself in that way. Like, I know, you know, there's people who fix art that was torn or, you know, reproduced. And so there's some question there too. I guess it's a similar dynamic, but this seems to be even more like, come on.
Yeah. Well, you're really dealing with artificial scarcity and sort of artificial provenance, which people do value in the art world, but it's a factor of physical media. You know, if the company that made your H.R. Giger statue goes out of business, or it's not really a problem for you, the statue won't disappear. If the company that made the shelf you display it on goes out of business, you'll still have the shelf. But, you know, if OpenSea, which is the main NFT market, has problems, or whoever is hosting the actual NFT or the JPEG or whatever, you know, it's much more wrapped up in these other companies and systems than they would like us to think in the supposedly decentralized world where everyone is sovereign over their own digital assets. It's really not like that in practice.
It definitely feels like there's some people who have too much cash.
And that's for sure.
That's the problem.
Yeah, but you worry more about the people that don't have that much cash who are getting suckered by this. Like, that's I think that's the
absolutely. And I think a lot of retail traders, as they're called, are losing or risking more than they can afford to lose.
Jacob Silverman, staff writer at the New Republic. Look forward to that upcoming book, Easy Money, co-written with Ben McKenzie. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And folks, we're going to head into the fun half. See if the, because we could take the, that teapot off of the.
It's off. The filter was only on Jacob's output, but yeah. Should have cleared up.
Yeah, I mean, it was something to do with his connection.
Yeah, it sounded exactly like a teapot.
It sounded like a teapot, but it wasn't actually a teapot.
Once he was boiling the log, kettle of tea.
I'm getting asked about the Giger art. Yes. In 2004, I think it was, or 2003, I used to hang out at a bar. And the bar must have been like the end of, like, around 2000. Yeah, maybe it was actually like late 90s. And I had all this sitcom money, and I was hanging out at this bar, which was my regular go-to bar on 3rd Avenue. And Giger's like New York, like maybe his only like art rep hung out there. And there was a statue in the bar of the birth machine baby. I'll tell the story in the fun half. What am I giving away for free? This is a great story. Great story about how, again, my business acumen. Folks, speaking of my lack of business acumen, you can support this program by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half, and you allow this show to survive and thrive. jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget the live show. Get the your streaming tickets for Brooklyn this weekend at amquickie.com. It's going to be a cavalcade. So I guess it's really It's like a homecoming. It's like a, I don't know what else to call it. But check it out. You're going to enjoy it. Get that streaming ticket. If you sign up for the AM Quickie at amquickie.com, check out the email the next day. You will get, it'll be $5. $5. Quite a deal. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Tonight on Left Reckoning, we'll be talking with Nick Bolin. He's a correspondent from High Country News about rural America, the class structure of different parts of it, and also the partisan politics of it, and how those two things are pretty disconnected. That's tonight, Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. I'll also talk about how Sturgis has been taken over by like a private company against the, and sort of forcing it into, basically last year, a bunch of Sturgis residents didn't want the rally to happen because of COVID and stuff like that. And turns out when you privatize a lot of these decisions and put them in the hands of private companies, that you can't say whether you want the bikers to come to your community or not. So a little bit of a careful what you wish for in terms of turning your country.
That's what happened with Chicago's parking meters.
Oh yeah. A very similar story actually. Yeah.
They sell off the parking meters, and then all of a sudden they realize, like, wait a second, we can't, we've got a ton of, like, we can't get rid of these cars, or we can't do a pedestrian walkway on this street because we've got to pay for the revenue for this for 99 years.
I just, also just want to say one quick thing about blockchain. Like, there's the history of accounting, which has double entry bookkeeping, which was very important to like merchants in like Venice, for instance. That took care of all this. You don't need a third entry bookkeeping, which is a blockchain, promises. It's just redundant. The double entry bookkeeping did all of the things that blockchain is supposed to.
Yeah.
Do. Well, that's why with the Sammy dollars, we don't use that.
For it, quadruple entry.
We do. We use quadruple entry bookkeeping with the Sammy dollars, which we're going to introduce soon. We're going to be looking for investors into the Sammy dollars.
Sam coin.
Well, actually, maybe we should call it Emma dollars, so that when Sammy takes off with all the investment money, Emma,
that's the namesake branding. Of
the dollars, is left holding the bag.
Mm-hmm. And I have no plausible deniability at that point either.
It's called Emma dollars.
I know. I mean, good. You're good. You're getting good at scamming people. Congrats.
I honestly do think that we should have like early on did the.
If we did a scam, a joke coin. I mean, that's what Dogecoin was. It was like kind of. I mean, maybe I'm getting that history a little bit wrong, but.
No, it is. It's. Yeah. I think it's on a bar stool or something stupid.
And then it became like a sort of real thing. And I honestly think that we could have.
It's like a Dianetics, right? Yeah. I mean, there's like how like. L. Ron Hubbard was like, I wonder if I could start a religion. And then like,
he did it.
I
mean,
yeah, he would, right. Thinking big.
I mean, I will say, there was a time like 8 years ago, 6 years ago, we were like, should we just take, Bitcoin as a.
We took some from that, from a site, didn't we?
No, there was, we did sign up for, let's get to do this. Yeah, in the fun.
646-257-3920.
Excuse me?
Yep.
What was the middle numbers?
646-257-3920.
Okay. Oh, I just got a report. Lindsey Graham stormed out of meeting the
He's really like this.
How many times can you go to that stormings? Well?
Soon he's going to like throw wine like a real housewife.
Right. Unbelievable.
You bitch.
We'll be right back after this. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Who?
Fun. What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it!
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.